Good evening, friends. Welcome back to the Front Porch. My name is Dennis Rogers, and I'm joined by Michael Daniels. How's it going, Mike? How was your Monday?
It's beautiful, Dennis. Beautiful. Got a beautiful weekend. Played some games, watched some movies. Had a good time.
By beautiful, you mean this, like, hot, overcast, muggy with a tiny bit of rain that we've had today?
Oh, yeah, I guess that.
I don't think the weather is too different half an hour south.
True. Or, yeah. Yeah. That's funny. I had to think of today. Today, you're correct. When you talk about weather, it's fine. It's, but the weekend's been pretty good. I was up in Chicago this last weekend.
Sure.
So it was a little bit away from here. It wasn't...
Yeah, the weather wasn't too bad down here. We've been the property down here is infested with gnats, which is annoying, but yeah, I'm rolling out next weekend, so.
I got to visit, you know, just visit some friends up there, and I think Troy's been on the show, so friend of the show Troy, and got to.
I don't know if we've had Troy on.
If not, we'll have to have him on.
Yeah.
We stayed up until midnight or one. He had made some mead about 3 months ago or something, and finally got it to where he wants it to be. So we cracked open some of that, just a little bit of it, and talked about comic books for 2 hours, and then movies for another hour and a half, such like that. And I was just already exhausted from the day, and
I've been hearing more and more about mead lately.
Yeah,
I guess I shouldn't say that, like, it's phenomenal. And I stayed at a meadery in California, which I maybe talked about at the time. They do a harvest host. I forget the name, and then they changed it. No, wait, it was something clever. Something remedies, like remedies, but with mead in the middle. And they were kind of nerdy, especially the husband. It's a husband and wife there in the mountains up between. It was somewhere between Yosemite and Sequoia National Park, so like way up state California.
Yeah.
And he gave me the whole spiel, all the story, the little anecdotes, and then like another group that was staying, like they had gone somewhere out for the day and then came in, so I got to hear some of the spiel again, just hanging out in their tap room. But it's like one of the more expensive kinds of alcohol. It's more expensive than wine because you have to use honey, and yeah, honey is more expensive per, you know, weight or whatever compared to grapes, which you can just grow. Like for honey, you've got to have bees, and then there's all this. It's up in that part of California, there are a lot of orchards,
right?
So he had the different honey close to different kinds of trees. And, you know, there's like pear honey and orange honey and stuff like that. I don't know.
The different kinds, like when you think honey, you're going to put anything, oh, it's going to be super sweet, which that's not wrong. The first mead I ever had was very, very, very sweet, like way too sweet. And then sure, I was like, oh man, I don't like mead. And then I've had different kinds of mead since then, lots of different kinds. And they're just a wide variety. You can very have semi-sweet, dry type stuff. And yeah. His was pretty good. It was very close to beery tasting type stuff without any kind of sugary flavor.
Right.
But yeah, we did that and talked about stuff. And I do like mead in general. Yeah, just it is more expensive, you're right, but I tend to like it a little bit better than normal beer, I guess. And the craze has been to go to IPAs in the last 10, 15 years. And I just don't jive with that myself. So go
as long as they're not too hoppy. I don't even want to say 5 years, like the last 2 years, it feels like hazy IPAs are the new thing, which I like some of those too.
Yeah the bitterness. I've never been a bitter flavor person in almost anything that I have. So anyway, yeah, saw that. Went Chicago's cool town, just in general, and we ate pizza at Gino's. There's two big Chicago, old school Chicago pizza places, Giordano's and Gino's. Giordano's has expanded. I don't know if Gino's has a big chain presence, but I know Giordano's is everywhere now. But it's the th really thick, literally like 2 inches thick, pie. It's a pizza pie.
Deep dish pizza. I've been to Giordano's. I don't know if I've been anywhere other than the one. There's one that's, I wouldn't say across the street. There's one that's really close to Midway Airport.
Yeah, they're all over. Like literally every other block in Chicago now is like a Giordano's.
I know they're all over now. I've only been to that one because most of my family always fly Southwest, and they Southwest goes through Midway.
Yeah, they the I my difference big difference between those two is that Giordano's has a lot more crust, like it's bready crust, so it seems to be a thicker pie, but half of it is bread on the bottom. And where Gino's is a thinner on the bottom crust, and by as a result a thinner pie, but it's actual, ingredients instead of a lot of bread. And then they also, and to Gino's credit, they have an outside crust. It's very, very light, flaky, and buttery. It's like a, it's almost like a what's a patisserie? What am I thinking there? What's the word? Pastry.
Pastry.
Yeah. It's like a pastry crust to it.
Patisserie is a place that makes pastry.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of. What was? So it's a pastry crust, which is
It's
just delicious.
still, but it's still deep dish.
Still deep dish, yes, but
Yeah,
not like as
the
deep.
Chicago style.
The real one, and there's one I know Troy was talking about. Anyone's around Chicago is probably yelling, "Hey, you should try this." There's one that I tried the first time I was in Chicago, the first time I ever had Chicago deep dish, and I've not had it since, and I want to. Is where they put it's deep dish with a normal crust, like we see a normal pizza crust. Lots of ingredients, and then another crust on top. So it is genuinely a pizza pie. And that's kind of where it comes from, is that they were
Sounds like
pies with meats.
a calzone or a
Like a calzone.
stromboli.
Kind of, except those are kind of wrapped in it. That's more like a pizza burrito. These are, you slice a pie just like you would apple pie or something, where you.
Sure, like a pie with a top crust. Sure, that's what
Correct,
that means.
correct. And I actually like that the best. Those are my favorite Chicago pizzas. I'll go on record here and say, much to the chagrin of people, I was with us last weekend where we all had great, wonderful tasting Gino's pizza, which it was phenomenal. New York style pizza is still my favorite pizza. And just the bigger, larger, foldable crust where the crust has New York pizzas, like good New York pizzas or like genuine New York pizzas, say, really focus on the stuff that's under the crust and the seasoning, because when
Okay,
you
sure.
fold it, the crust is on the outside, and that's really that crunch and the flavor of that crust and the seasoning on the outside of the crust is a very important thing mixed with the ingredients of the middle. And I just like that better. I like that crunchy, crispy crust folded over. Not like a cracker crust, because that's what a lot of people like, cracker crust, but just a crispy crust. And it's, yeah, I just like New York pizzas a lot better. Sydney and I have sampled both places lots of times, and that's definitely, I think, our go-to stuff is the New York pizza. Anyway, Gino's pizza, we did that. Spent a lot of time at Navy Pier. If anyone's in anywhere near the Chicago pizza or pizza, the Chicago area, you should get Garrett's, so you probably already know what Garrett's popcorn is. We're not being sponsored by them, but it's one of those things that you go and you say, "It's just popcorn, Michael." And then you go up to the store, their little thing downtown Chicago, and there's a line every single time that goes down the block to just get popcorn. Because their popcorn is just crazy good. Just something about it tastes. I mean, it's the stuff, whatever they put, like the cheddar they put on the outside of it, and the caramel tastes different, and their mix of their special kind of cheddar and their special kind of caramel taste anything different than you get at Christmas in those tins, let me tell you. So,
well, yeah, I mean, it's fresh, first of all.
Yes, for sure. And it's just hyper addictive. You take literally two kernels, one caramel, one cheddar, put it in your mouth, eat it, and you're instantly like, give me more right now. it's insane. But and I stood in line the first time just because somebody told me and I thought it was silly, ate it, and now it's that every time I go to Chicago, I must get a bag of Garrett's. So put a plug out for them, guys. And I loved that. And we went to the Navy Pier and saw the boats and saw the stuff, and super windy as the Windy City is. Yeah, good times. What'd you do this last week? Anything good?
I did some more, what's the word I'm looking for? Not chores, but, projects, that I've had kind of hanging out. I bought a bike rack to hang my bike over the tongue, the front of my camper, my RV.
Mm-hmm.
I bought that back in November. I think it was maybe a sale, a Black Friday. It wasn't quite Black Friday yet, or maybe it was. I don't know. Anyway, yeah. I bought it back in November and have been hauling it around because how technical do I need to get into this? Probably not too technical. It's difficult to install in camp because I have to take the jack that holds the front of the tongue up. I have to take it off because it mounts in the same spot. Like they mount together in those bolt holes in the tongue. And so I've just been carrying it around. And while I was here, I was like, oh, I should do that. And I've been here almost 2 months and I'm like, okay, I'm getting ready to leave this weekend. I need to really do that. Yeah. It wasn't this week. I actually had that thought a week and a half ago because I was going to leave earlier. But I'm sticking around because I made an appointment at the vet for the pup. Oh, and nice. It's easier just to get established with a vet here because I'll be back here at least once a year. Anyway, I opened up that box because I did some other projects that day. I had to replace the switch in the jack.
You replaced your switch?
Not Nintendo Switch. The electrical switch in the jack would only go down and not up. And I'm like, okay, I look at the wires and they're fine. But I ended up just replacing that myself. I found another switch at the auto parts store. And while I was doing that, that's around that area, the tongue of the RV, it's like I should finally install that tongue jack or that bike rack. And I opened it up. It's missing almost all the pieces. It's, how do I describe it? There's a big vertical column that has a kind of yoke that attaches to it that moves everything back a few inches. Okay. And that has two like wings that go up in a Y. And then you attach these like pegs onto those wings and they have rubber straps. So you rest the bike on those pins, the straps go around the bike and it rests on that Y. And it's designed to hold two bikes. I only have one. It's also an e-bike, so it's a little heavier, so I wouldn't put a second bike up there anyway.
Yeah.
And then of course it has instruction manual and a bunch of bolts and cotter pins and stuff to put it all together.
What's a cotter pin?
The original box I got from Amazon had that big vertical piece and the two wings for the Y. It didn't have the yoke that connects those together, and there were no bolts, no pins, no rubber straps, no instruction manuals, no bolts. Just like the three biggest pieces. So the box was still heavy. And it still rattled around in the backseat of my car, my Jeep, and now my truck, for the last, I don't know, 5 months.
Okay.
4 or 5 months. And I'm like, don't be sad. And of course, I'm way out of the Amazon return window.
Of course, like, right? Of course, yeah.
Returns at Amazon are super easy. If you didn't know,
they really like, are.
Like, you go on the website of the app, you say I want to return this, you tell them why, and then you take it to a UPS store. You right. don't have to put it in a box. You don't have to print a label. I did have to print a label. I did have to print a label once. I bought some Bluetooth keyboards for my phone in case I wanted to like do some typing on my phone. And I couldn't tell which one I was going to like the style of, how it folds up, how it folds down, how it feels to type. I'm like, I just need to try it. I need to buy it and try it because I can't tell from the pictures how big it is. It's going to be too big to fit in my pocket, too small for my hands, whatever. So I bought three of these things and I kept one of them and I returned the other two. Well, I had to print out a label because they have batteries in them, right? That like you plug them in and charge because they're Bluetooth keyboards. And apparently if you return stuff with batteries, you have to actually print a label and it's a couple more steps.
Okay.
I mean, it's a UPS store, so I had them print the label. They charged me like $3 for printing that out, but whatever.
Right.
Anyway, I couldn't return the thing to the bike rack to Amazon. So I emailed the manufacturer, which is a company called Lippert, Lippert.
Okay.
They are up where I and my family used to live in northern Indiana, as a lot of RV and RV parts manufacturers are located. But I told them the story and they're like, okay, well, you know, you could try to do a return with Amazon, but here are the things we need. Amazon requires of us to make a claim. You know, okay. We need pictures of the missing parts. We want to see the orders, you know, some part of the original order where it says sold by or shipped by Amazon, order number, et cetera, et cetera. And so I took all those pictures. I took a picture of the box, the sticker on the box, opened the box up, laid the parts out. I'm like, here are the parts. Here's a picture down the box. You can see there's nothing else in it.
Mm-hmm.
And they sent me a new one. Super easy.
Nice. Barely an inconvenience.
Yeah. Yeah. And anyway, so Saturday or Sunday, I did something else Sunday. I don't remember what. But yeah, that was a good part of my Saturday, was getting that installed and then getting the pins adjusted right so the bike sits up there and get it strapped in. Because what I've been doing is bringing the bike in and out of the RV every time I move and like strapping it down,
okay.
Which is a whole process. Like, at least now it's up, out of the way. I've got somewhere to keep it when I'm not using it. And, yeah. Yeah, so that was my big thing.
That was a lot you did there.
yeah. It's just kind of, you know, like some other things. A couple weekends before, I hung a shelf. Just a... put some stuff on. I bought a Lego set, which was dumb, but
Lego Harry Potter set. I'm gonna sit and
bought it right after Christmas. It's that little Sakura Blossom.
Sydney made that already. I saw her make it. Yep.
I bought that right after Christmas. They were on sale and I had my eye on it like since last Christmas when we did the Saturn V rocket. Like, that's cool. Put it together and then I don't like it's just a little too big to put anywhere, and so I hung a shelf on the wall so I can't stick it, which is
nice. But have you seen those they're called Nook? They're like bookshelf ends, where they called it like the bookends, and they're like little miniature crafty things that you build and put together, when they sit on your shelf, it looks like you're looking down an alleyway with all the little stuff in it, or it'll have like a little shop. They're like 4 inches, maybe four inches wide by, I don't know, standard 12 inches tall. And then it goes a book deep, and you put them in your shelf, and it just looks like it's a little, like I said, an alleyway or a bookstore inside of it, and little miniature stuff. And you put them all together, like, you know, you pop them out of the stuff and put all the little pieces together. I'm signaling with my pinchers on my fingers, as if you can see them, with tweezers and stuff, and put them all together and fit them together. And then you put LED lights in them, and it lights up. They're very, very cool and super popular these days. And it was at our bookstore, and Sydney had bought one of them and brought them over, and it was called the Sakura, whatever this thing is. And I thought, this is really neat, but I'd never seen it before. They're expensive. They're like $50 a piece, but super, super cool. I'll have to send you a link in the thing. I feel ill-equipped to talk about it, because it just kind of came up, but... Those who are out there now, they're yelling at their thing, duh, it's this. But anyway, they're very cool bookend craft things. I can't. They're called book nook kits.
Book nooks. Yes, I've seen those on TikTok.
Yeah. See, now I told you the word. I knew you'd get it.
Yeah, they're like a tiny little diorama that you put.
That's
in
it. See. Shelf. All the words are coming from your mouth are correct. All mine are just jumbled mess of nothing. Diorama of stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're very cool. People go on to and do a Google search for that. You'd be like, oh, that's a really neat little cartoon. So you mentioned like Legos, and it's kind of like that. It's not Legos, but you put them all together in a little crafty thing, and it comes in one big box. And they're very, very cool. And I think I'm thinking about getting one and doing one myself, because Sydney just... blew through it in one day and made it. I was like, oh, geez. Don't tell her, but I bought some for her birthday. She'll get it. Okay, so I've got a couple things to talk about this week. I want to talk about Shogun, spend some time on Shogun, because we both finished that, so we'll go into full spoiler mode with that thing. But I got a question, just a general conversation piece to ask you about. There's an interview by the Russo brothers, the guys who made, you know, a lot of things, but their most recent big thing that you know them from is they made the Avengers movies from Infinity War and Endgame. Mm-hmm. And there's some interview, I can't remember what it was for, but they had been asked about Marvel's struggles on the big screen, and they had some choice thoughts about it. And it made me think, I wonder what Dennis thinks about this kind of stuff. They had mentioned their quote kind of says there's a big generational divide about how you consume media. And they say that, you know, it's a very different, I'm going to quote them, you know, it's a very different moment in time it's ever been. There is a generation that used to an appointment viewing to go to a theater on a certain date to see something. They would say, I'm going to go Friday at this time to go see something. Right. And the current generation doesn't really do that. They want what they want. And they want it now. And they want to be doing other things at the same time. Right.
Sure.
So the form of current movie, the way we've been doing things for, you know, this last generation is very stuck in its ways. That you go to the movie theater, you watch a 2-hour thing. First off, 2 hours is different for the current generations and younger. And the idea is that the paradigm could change. Now, this is going away from what they were talking about, but their basic thing was that the movie theater, the way that it's provided is, and the content is provided, is not in sync with how people consume media today. And I think of things like, why do movies have to be 2 hours long for $17 or $15, whatever it is? Why can't they take a thing? Why can't movies be, or theaters be set up so that you can, there's half hour shows that you go to watch and you pay $5 for. And it's like a series, let's say Shogun, and it's eight episodes, half hour episodes. Let's say Shogun is an hour. But, and you go to theater, you pay $5. 3 months later, another one comes out, it's $5. So that you can go out, watch a quick show, for a cheaper amount of money, but overall it would be, you know, it's if you pay that in 2 hours, that would be $20. So the theaters see an increase in money with less time, they get more content in type stuff. It's just, I think the way that we look at theaters is kind of a problem that we have now of still sticking to that old way of making it an event that you have to go and do, and you sit for 2-3 hours, 30 minutes of ads beforehand, you know, having to spend a ton of money on popcorn. That whole thing should be rethought. And that's, if they don't do that, it ends up dying out. Do you think that the movie theater experience can be changed in such a big way, not just small things like changing prices or, you know, more comfortable chairs and things like that? Do you think they can actually change the way that people go see movies anymore?
I mean, yes, things can change. It's a bigger question in terms of like the big companies. There are really only like, I don't know, 4 or 5 theater companies at most.
Yeah.
And there might be more. Like, obviously, AMC is the big one. And then you've got Regal, Cinemark, had at least one. I don't know if... No, that's done. That was local anyway. The Marcus Group, the Alamo, right? So right, so there's scale. Like, Marcus and Alamo are pretty small. I think Alamo might be smaller even. And AMC is the big one. And obviously, maybe not obviously, but of course, it's changed. It has already changed, right? Like, theaters used to be one big screen because there was only a couple movies at a time.
True. You're right, right? Yeah.
And they used to show newsreels because people didn't have TV. Like, they might hear news on the radio, but a lot of people, you know, that's the main way they got visual news, was in the theater before the movie started.
Very true.
I think something like that could work, and I know that there are independent theaters that do things like that where they'll show old movies, right? Like you were saying last week about Dune 2, right? If you get to a point of, I mean, part of, I was in high school when the Star Wars re-releases happened, and I was too young for all of the original. I mean, I probably could have seen like Return of the Jedi or something when I was 5. But, you know, they re-released Star Wars in the theaters, and it was a big deal. I mean, we saw it like a month late because it was the late 90s, and that kind of stuff still happened where major releases didn't make it to small town theaters. Even like, the town wasn't that small, like 10,000 people, but it was a small theater, and
sure,
you know, they didn't get it until the second run. And I completely lost my train of thought. Oh, like before that, you couldn't see Star Wars in the theater, right? Like it didn't, and not even small theaters do that because like the AMC in Indianapolis will show Lord of the Rings during Gen Con. Correct. So that kind of stuff still happens where it's like, oh, here's another chance to see this. I don't know, Dances with Wolves or Gone with the Wind or, you know, whatever.
AMC Showcase does a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, something that once was a big theatrical experience to see it in the theater again. And I think there's probably a market for like streaming shows, like stuff that goes straight to streaming, and people are like, boy, I really wish I could have seen Stranger Things in the theater. And to do that, like,
yeah, that's a perfect example. Stranger Things in a theater, you know, you can charge a smaller amount than say a 3-hour show and release it into a smaller bit.
The scheduling of that gets tricky. I don't quite know how you, like, you know, if you're showing episodes, somebody has to commit to like going to, I mean, it's like TV used to be where you miss a week and now you don't know what's going on. And
correct.
Have to
correct.
Recaps.
Yeah.
Like that makes things more complicated.
And maybe it doesn't have to be like serial stuff. It could be, you know, if there was, let's say, Strange New Worlds, you know, don't make take Strange New Worlds off my TV, please. But, you know, it's kind of an episodic type content. You see a new Star Trek type thing that's 45 minutes long, that's high quality, high production, movie quality type stuff, and you only pay $5 and you're only in the theater for thing, but you're sitting in the reclining chairs and you've got a nice big thing, and it's a whole, maybe it's a different experience than you might have, and you can do it on a quick date or just with friends that we can go, hey, you want to, we just ate dinner, you want to go watch a half hour show over the theater quick for $5 and it doesn't take any time, that's, you know, Star Trek, it's an episodic thing that's not serial, because you're right, tricky with, oh, I missed the third one, now I can't, it's just the sixth one and things like that. But I'm thinking more, you know, episodic type content for things. But anyway, it's an idea.
I mean, maybe. I think there are a lot of things theaters can do that are less drastic, yeah, to improve numbers. You know, like have the movie start sooner. Right,
for
you,
minimum you, as a bare minimum, right?
You were just saying about the 2 hour thing, but it's not 2 hours; it's at least 2.5. Because if you get there before they dim the lights, there's a half hour of trailers and ads. Not just trailers, like we're used to the trailers, but legitimate like T-Mobile and Coca-Cola ads. And I'm like, okay, I get there's a whole conversation around ads with broadcast or streaming TV and like revenue for producing the shows and the movies. But everything at a theater is expensive. The tickets are expensive. The concessions are expensive. And I get that theaters rely on concessions because most of the ticket prices go back to the studios, distribution companies, all that stuff. But like that whole thing is expensive. And then you've got to sit and watch a T-Mobile ad. Come on.
Right. Right. For sure.
And then, yeah, your 2 hour experience becomes at least 2.5 hours. Because of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I just kind of always like to think that, when there's a problem, you know, or as some people say that there's an opportunity when you see that things are stagnating or, getting worse or, things going out, there seems to always be entrepreneurs will often look at things and say, that means there's an opportunity. If there's something is good and it's losing attraction, what there's an opportunity there somewhere. You got to find it and figure out how to change the paradigm.
I don't necessarily want to say before COVID, but like in the late 20 teens, is that what we're calling it? I spent a fair bit of time watching a guy on YouTube and looking around on the internet for theaters for sale. I sort of hoped and assumed that a decent amount would go under during the pandemic, and that happened. I think probably just companies like AMC bought them all.
Yeah, that's kind of going to be a problem. I mean, I think it's a lot of problem for a lot of industries, but you know, refusing to adapt and trying to squeeze every bit of they can and clawing on to the old way, and you know, then they're doing changing.
We've complained about the Bloomington theater several times in the last month or so.
For sure,
I don't know what the problem is with that one, because there are a lot of nice AMC theaters. Like, why is AMC not investing in a theater in a town the size of Bloomington?
Yeah, and that you know, that could be tainting my opinion of theaters too, is that while I do go to Indy often to watch films, my weekly film that I'll go and sit there and watch a pickup film is a really crappy experience overall. So that probably does taint my.
And I think process. a lot of the conversation, you know, I try to avoid a lot of the conversation around generational stuff, because so much of it is just like stereotypes and nonsense. But
of course. But there are differences the way
the thing you're talking about is like second screen, right? They call second screen.
Correct. Yeah.
Where, you know, this is, I mean, and you and I talked about that without maybe necessarily using that term, like this is a show I can have on in the background.
Yeah. We talk about that often. Yeah.
And I think the music piracy thing in the late 90s, early 2000s, like, the answer to that is not, you know, a director, producer saying, you know, my movie is only going to be in a theater and you're going to have to wait a year before it shows up on streaming, just like a draconian top-down thing. But it's to make the theater experience more appealing, right?
Correct.
Make,
yeah.
make, have those amenities, the good sound, the nice seats, things that make people feel like they're getting their money's worth.
For
because
sure.
Everything is expensive right now. And it, you know, I mean, that whole conversation around Dune 2, like, I spent $35, which is not an insane amount of money. Like, it's a lot for some people, but, you know, it's not like I'm going to the theater, I'm expecting to spend money. And then the experience was really, really subpar. I'm like,
right.
Why did I do that? Like, if I had gone to a, you know, if I was in a small town somewhere on my travels and went to a no-name independent theater and spent $7 on a ticket or whatever, I'd be like, okay, yeah, that's kind of, you know, I didn't really expect anything more than that. But it was not that. It was
right.
considerably more expensive than that.
Absolutely.
Anyway.
I'm always looking for ways to make the theater still the thing, because I still love it so much, you know, and sure. enjoy the time. So moving on from that one, the, I don't know if I want to go to, by the way, it's theater experience. I need to go see Godzilla, because that's usually one of those things that's theater stuff. But
Godzilla, Rise of the Kong Beast.
Rise of the Kong Beast, yeah. I mean, it feels like a silly movie that I should be giddy and watch about, because it's dumb. I haven't read any reviews of it, because I just immediately assume everybody that's like a pinky up critic is going to hate it, and everybody else is going to be like, it's the best movie ever, because they're, you know, like the least common denominator. Anyway, I want to see it. I guess we can talk about our movie now. I wanted to transition into something else. Well, I want to transition to Shogun, actually, real bad. But let's talk about A Knight's Tale.
All right. We are talking about A Knight's Tale from 2001, starring Heath Ledger, Mark Addy, Rufus Sewell, Alan Tudyk, Laura Fraser, what's the girl? I'm not going to try and pronounce her name.
I have not seen her in a lot of stuff, but obviously we see Alan. So this is a while ago. This show was out before a lot of these people did a lot of stuff. But having Paul Bettany, Tudyk, Heath Ledger, it's a pretty decent cast before they were like as big as they are now.
Yeah.
But she, I hadn't seen her. I don't think I've seen her in anything else since.
Oh, the guy, it's Robert Baratheon.
I didn't know. Oh, that's him. Right. Okay, yes. Makes sense. Yeah.
I was like,
Chaucer or something like that.
Roland is the character's name.
Roland, okay.
The actor is Mark Addy. Chaucer is Paul Bettany's character.
Okay, yeah, okay. Got the names confused there. So what do you think?
So we alluded to this a little bit last week, but I saw this when it was relatively new and was just like almost offended at the historical inaccuracy and anachronicity. I don't know if that's a word. Of this movie. I'm like, that isn't right. They wouldn't say that, you know, why they wouldn't be doing this. They wouldn't have this song, like all of that, like deep in the, you know, this, it came out right at the same time when my family were doing Civil War reenacting. And so we were real like pedantic, actually about historical accuracy.
I was too, FYI. When this
and I heard this come up on a podcast or something. And I was like, you know, I bet if I went into it knowing that and like already deciding like, okay, this isn't going to, I'm not going to get hung up by this. I'm not going to get hung up on this because I know that it's there and let's look past it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, a few years ago, I don't know, 6-7 years ago or something, my sister and I watched several seasons of the CW series Rain. R-A-G-N, Rain, like Royal Rain. Sure. And it's about Mary, I think it's Mary Queen of Scots.
Mary Queen of Scots, yeah.
And the Dauphin of France, and Catherine de Medici. It's Megan Follows from the original Anne of Green Gables adaptation. Okay. And it's, you know, it's CW, right? So it's a lot of melodramatic relationship stuff. The costumes are all over the place, just like not even close to accurate to the period. Just like, yeah, it's like a Ren Faire prom, not even Ren, but like Renaissance, like whatever that era is, like prom. It's like it's this, and we'll put lace there, and have the characters all look beautiful because it's CW, and whatever. So anyway, I went into this like, okay, I'm gonna be a little bit easier on it, maybe. Yeah, and it's fun to see all these actors 20 years ago. You know, Rufus Sewell and Alan Tudyk. This is not even that young Alan Tudyk, because this is a year before. Like Firefly was next year after this.
Oh, okay, yeah. So this was before his Wash days.
Yeah, but just barely, right?
Like, yeah, right, yeah.
The year before. And there were several moments in this movie that I laughed out loud at. Just, sure, like, some funny turn of phrase. A lot of Paul Bettany's lines are fantastic.
Yeah.
And the soundtrack, there's just random, you know, of course they do the We Will Rock You right at the beginning of the
right scene. At the beginning, yeah.
I feel like there was another Queen song. There's at least one David Bowie song.
And it's one thing if there's just the song in there, but like it's part of the show. Like they're mm-hmm. doing the clap clap psh, type stuff and yeah, dancing to the that.
I think, yeah, that's one
like
time
it's
it
in
happens
universe, not just for us.
Yeah, yeah, and then at the ball or whatever at the dance, they do this elaborate choreographed dance to, I think that's Bowie's Golden Years, and I'm like, okay, sure, like just again, I went into the movie knowing that this stuff was there, and it just like it's not, I don't know whether to call it satire, because it's not really satire, but it's just like, it just can't be. It's like everybody's kind of having fun with it.
Sure. Yeah.
And so, yeah, I thought it was a good time. Like some of the relationship stuff is a little dated now. But otherwise, like it's just a fun, silly kind of, you know, like Monty Python historical.
Yeah. Monty Python's that's kind of a good. I talked to again Troy this weekend. Is one thing. It's so funny how some of these things just got brought up that were relevant to what we're doing. And he said we were talking about actually what I brought up was The Barbarians and how we had watched that. And I was like, it's just, you know, bad, good. It's camp. It's just silly. And how sometimes I like to watch you know, just easy films that some people don't like. Like for a long time, I liked the first Transformers just because it was what it was, or Bumblebee. You know, it doesn't have to be a critical acclaim or have some kind of cinematic value to it for me to just enjoy something. Sometimes it annoys me too much. And he said, "Oh yeah, exactly." Like he says, "I always put on all the time A Knight's Tale," and I'm like, "Oh really? I'm gonna have to watch that tomorrow night." And then he explained about it. One thing he said was, he called it a sports movie, in with a medieval skin. I was like, sports mm-hmm. music. Yeah. The sports is jousting. And
yeah.
That's what it's, you're watching.
It's definitely the, like, you know, the nobody guy, you know, like Longest Yard, or
Yeah.
what was the one with Keanu Reeves, the
The
Replacements,
Replacements.
where it's like, oh, he's gonna come in, and he, you know, there's a montage of fights where he, you know, he climbs to the top to get to the tournament, and they go from town to town, and he's, you know, if he wins this one, he can go on to nationals, right? That's exactly
Right.
what it is.
Yeah. And I was
And
like,
he's
you're
got his,
right.
you know, trainers when he comes off, you know, they're in the corner and they're hyping him up, and like in a boxing movie.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah,
And I was
that's
like, I
good.
never really looked at it that way. And so that did help a little bit, seeing it that way. And it helped doing what you just said. Like, okay, I know that's there. I know it's not historically accurate. It's accurate. It doesn't, the costumes, the soundtrack, and fine. Now, all that taken into account, I don't have a lot to say about it because it's just there. I think the film is neither good or bad, nor interesting nor uninteresting. Most of the jokes just landed, but they weren't like, oh my God, that's the best. And I'm not going to quote anything from this movie. Even when I was thinking of a quote for the title of our episode this week, I couldn't really think of anything that was out there.
You're not gonna call it. It's called a Lance. Hello.
Yeah. See, exactly. That's my point. You saying my point there. The love interest or the love story there, romance, was okay. The he's not a noble thing was solved within one quick scene. I did like the last joust battle because the villain is sufficiently a jerk, but he didn't. But he's just a jerk like any other sports jock guy that wants to get the, you know, guy expelled from college because he doesn't have high enough grades or something. Kind of bad guy. But there is one thing that did stand out that still brought it down for me was, for some reason, they switch back into kind of almost an old English prose when they say things. Especially when Heath Ledger's talking to his love interest in the show, he'll come to her and he'll start speaking with this old English kind of speech. And then he goes back and talks to everybody else and they're speaking like they're speaking today. And it goes from 1 minute to the next, they'll say a phrase like it's an old English and they'll say it back like they're, oh, we want you to say this point. And then they'll go back to modern English. And I just didn't like, what do you want me to do here? Do you want me to take this as if they're in English time period? It was really confusing. And I was like, okay, that's bothering me. It bothered me.
That to me was more clear when they do the thing with the letter where he gets a little anecdote from each of his teammates and puts it all in the letter. I think most of that, I didn't really notice that as much, except that, I mean, other than, how do I want to say this? Other than just part of him, like, being nervous around her and trying to impress her,
right.
And so was just more careful with his words and tried to be more, flashy or poetic.
Yeah, which I can get that, but it was just such a different way of speaking. Like if he spoke that way, wouldn't everybody speak that? And also she spoke normal and modern and then she wouldn't. There was no consistency to it at all.
Sure.
And I don't know, and I know that can be sound like, oh, you're nitpicking. I get it. It was just distracting for me, and that's why I pointed it out. But besides that, I don't have much to say about this one. It's a solid 4 to me, even not even a 5, just because I don't have anything that's interesting about it. I can say if to bring it up to a 5 is that, hey, I didn't remember Paul Bettany before for Vision, you know. Or this is Alan Tudyk before Alan Tudyk was actually funny. Because I didn't think his character was all that interesting. Heath Ledger's still great. He's a very charming actor. He was a charming actor back then.
How he was going to thong everybody.
He's going to thong. Yeah, sure. Yeah,
pain.
Yeah.
Yep. So much pain.
So much pain. Yeah, that recurring thing kept happening. So yeah, nothing bad. It wasn't terrible. It was if the modern music and I don't know, lack of anything, but maybe a high school ish type plot bothers you. But if you like, we went into it expecting that. If as long as you expect that, then it puts it at a 4 or 5. I'd probably say it a 5, because 4 means, to me, 4 out of 10 means you don't want to go see it or don't want to watch it. It's fine if it's on. It's not going to offend you. You're not going to be like, oh my God, that's terrible. You know?
Right.
But I wouldn't recommend it to anyone. There's, you know, if you want to watch a Heath Ledger romance movie, go watch 10 Things I Hate About You. Yes, this is the only like high school movie that I can think of set in the medieval times. So that gives it a little bit of pluses. I can't think of another one, but there's just no real hook for this for me on this one. I think I've exhausted my critique of it with that.
I think it for the most part succeeded at what it was trying to do.
You're not wrong there for sure. I think it is what it is.
I would call it, for me personally, I would call it good bad. And maybe that might even not be the right, but like campy, the choices seemed intentional. I don't know about the accent speaking thing. Oddly, you know, of the two of us, I would have thought that I would notice stuff like that more, than you did, but I really didn't, maybe just because my expectations for this were so low.
And that's helpful too. See, I think it's funny how when we rate or think of things, like, do we take that into consideration? The fact that we don't have anything really expecting of this thing, which tends to rate it higher. Is that a thing? Or if you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, if you know what a movie is, you're not expecting it to be something different. So you're not going to be disappointed by it. As far as numbers, I don't know. I mean, what do you like? What would I rate Monty Python and the Holy Grail 1 out of 10? I mean, from 1 to 10.
It's clearly not
quality of production and storytelling and cohesive plot or anything. Like, it's like a 3.
I guess when I say, you're right, I should be a little bit more clear on this one. When I say something like, it's a number out of something, that's a very, very general number. We you and I have talked about this in the past. You can't say that something is 4, it's a sci-fi drama, and then another Monty Python's a 4, a 6 or a 7, and it's a comedy silly thing. I guess when I say it's a 4 out of 10 for a high school, I'm getting into Trotsky era of specific genre stuff, comparable to other films of this type, I would say, you know, where you've got a romance thing with a jock trying to become, you know, beat his coming from humble beginnings to win a tournament and finds the girl along the way. In films like that, I would rate it a 4. There's other films that are better than this one. Is kind of what I'm saying. So it's not comparable to Monty Python and Holy Grail, because they're two different kind of things.
Sure.
So I guess I apologize for not being clear enough on that one. I should have been. Okay, so my turn next week.
Yep, correct? Your turn.
What are we going to do, Dennis? I am going to pick a silly one. I thought about going serious, but I need to have a little bit more silly in my life all the time. And it's an easy one to watch. One you haven't watched.
It's a silly movie, but
yes, I know. You're right. I kind of, I should bring it back around, but I'm not gonna.
Okay.
It'll be an easy one. It's an easy one. I think it's one that we can, you know, we can watch with a, you know, I feel like The Knight's Tale is also one that you could watch kind of with stuff going on in the background and not really pay too much attention to. Is Twins. This week is Twins with Danny DeVito and Arnold Schwarzenegger from the '80s, I want to say, or early '90s.
Danny DeVito and Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Batman villains?
Exactly. Right. And that's what made me think of it, was that they were on that, was it the Oscars or something?
They were on the Oscars, yeah.
When they come out and they talk about Batman films. And the first thing I thought of was like from Twins. But the premise is that of this show is it was two kids, or they scientists tried to make a perfect child, and they got all of the best genetics from many, many intelligent and incredible and perfect people from all around the world, take their genes, put them into a woman with a perfect egg, and make the perfect child. That's the impetus of the movie. And then somehow she had twins, and one of them was the perfect specimen, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and the other one was all the extra stuff that got left over. It makes no scientific sense, but that's what it is. And that's what you get with Danny DeVito.
Yeah.
But they're twins, so they're brothers, and it's supposed to be heartwarming. We'll see. I have not seen it in a long, long time, and you've not seen it at all. So let's get into our silly, keep our low expectation thing going for the third week in a row. We'll watch something serious. You could pick something serious for us next week. How's that?
I'll say I would watch A Knight's Tale again before I watch The Barbarians again.
Probably. How's probably
that for out of 10 rating?
Yeah, I'm probably right. I would watch Barbarians if the specific occasion arose to watch it, but would not volunteer to watch it on my own. But A Knight's Tale, I got nothing else on, and it's on the top of my thing. It's the very first thing on Netflix, and I'm doing laundry, and somebody's on the phone. Yeah, I'll push play on it. You know,
well, yeah, sure.
Type thing. Where I wouldn't do that for Barbarians. I'd skip to the next one. Okay, so twins for next week. Okay, so you want to talk Shogun? You want to talk Shogun finally? Shogun.
Shogun, okay. All right. I had some video game stuff, but we can talk about
Shogun. Oh, okay. I'm just excited to talk about Shogun.
I picked up a new game. It's called Railgrade. Not a lot to say about it. It's a...
Is it a train game?
It's a train game, sort of factory simulator, top down. It's just trains. And I've not played a ton of it yet, so I don't have a super in-depth review, but it has that model of, and it does have a sandbox mode, but it has a story mode where you go through missions from a world map, like okay. Super Mario World. Okay. I think that's the first, or did Mario 3. That's Mario Brothers 3 was the first that did that, I think. Where you have the map, right? And you go, you click on the mission you want to do. And the missions are timed, and you get a rating from, I don't know, D to S, right?
Okay. When did that whole S tier thing start?
I assume the studio is Japanese, because the names of the characters, like you get a little message from your buddy and supervisor, whatever, and he calls you Yoshida, and he's something else, and it's like Naka. It's very close to Nakatomi, but it's not. It's like Nakatani or something.
Okay.
And the money is yen in the game.
Okay.
But that's why the rating goes up to S, right? It goes A B, you know, D C B A S. Had to do that backwards. And so it has that thing where, like, you finish the mission, but you didn't finish it fast enough. Do you want to go back and do it again to try to get all 3 stars kind of thing, which is a little annoying. But I like the mission format because unlike a sandbox factory sim, like, I'm less likely to get sucked into it for 3.5 hours. I'm going to play a couple missions and go, okay, I'm going to do something else now. Like okay. We said about the one with the beavers against the storm.
Oh, the one with the beavers. Yes, I know the one right now.
They're beavers.
Did we ever see if Against the Storm was good when it actually came out? Watch. Have you ever played it since that actually launched?
I think I played it once, and then I went through a thing when my Windows computer was down. I couldn't play it, and now I just always have some other game. That I'm playing. I think our buddy Peter is still playing it occasionally.
Okay. I mean, nothing. There was nothing wrong with it. I remember it just.
No, I liked it. I liked it a lot. I think it started to feel repetitive after a while.
It did. That was I think what kind of stopped me from playing it. It's like,
and I don't know whether or how much they've changed that. I think they've maybe have added a new race and a couple other things. The other game that I bought and have been playing because they're on sale is SteamWorld Build.
I have too.
And I know you've been playing that. So if you're not familiar with it, the SteamWorld franchise games, I don't remember the company, but they have a series of games that are kind of all over the place genre-wise.
Really? Yeah.
And very cross-platform. I played Quest, SteamWorld Quest on the Switch, or I think it's on the Switch. I played SteamWorld Heist 1, or it's maybe SteamWorld Heist 2 on my phone on iOS. It's a shooty one.
Okay.
SteamWorld Quest is kind of an RPG, like a side-scrolly RPG. I don't think I've played Dig or a couple. They have a, like
SteamWorld Dig is great. It's an excellent game. I highly recommend
games.
It.
The unifying factor in these games is the world, and it's a steampunk world where you're playing sentient steam powered robots. They're bipedal humanoid robots,
right?
That wear hats and clothes and stuff and are run on steam, and SteamWorld Build is their town simulator, town builder kind of game. I played it when it was demo, and it's out now, and it went on sale. I don't know if it'll still be on sale by the time this airs, but I bought it. It was like, I don't know, 18 or 20 bucks. Something like
that. Most of these SteamWorld games are relatively inexpensive, you know, like full things. But they'll
do
have like a full
deals
game
and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So did you like it? I mean, was so far at least what you played?
I've gotten my town down to the fourth level, the third level of the mine.
Oh, okay.
Which is kind of the main.
You've played further than I have. I guess I'll tell you that much.
Seems like the main thing, like it's Western themed, which I think a lot of them are, though some are more sci-fi. It's still sci-fi, but sci-fi Western. Your group of robots come to this dusty, almost abandoned town. You have to build a town, you put down roads, you put down buildings for the people need services like a store and a repair shop, and you know you got to put the buildings together so that the people have their needs met, and then once they do, you get more, right? Like a building will hold so many people, but if it has all its needs met, it'll go up to its max number of people, and then you use people to run your factory buildings. Like you put a woodcutter down, it generates logs, and then you put a lumber mill down, it turns logs into planks, use planks to build stuff, and it just gets more complex from there. Eventually you repair and open the mine shaft, where you go down into the mine layer, right? It's got layers, right? So you hit the numbers to jump between the layers,
right?
And then you do mining stuff, right? If there's a big open space, it's danger of collapse, so you have to build a pillar there. You put areas on the floor, like the building in the mine is different from the building on the surface. It's all a grid of squares, and you need regular miners to dig new tunnels and collect resources that are just embedded in the cubes and the blocks of the layer, the mine layer. And so you put a marker on the floor, and each square of that costs a certain amount of money and planks or something. And depending on how big that floor is, determines how many miners you have, right? So you make a big area, and then you've got miners. And then they dig around, and then you unlock... The whole thing is milestones, right? You do enough things, then you unlock a new thing. You unlock prospectors who can go and get a different kind of resource and carry them. And then you get engineers who can... let you build machines where there's like there's an iron vein in the lair, and you put a machine next to it and it just auto like generates the iron from the iron mine, and then your prospectors will carry it back and forth to the mine shaft where it goes up to your town where you turn it into sheet metal to make other things. It just goes through, and your goal is to find pieces of a rocket that were left behind by some ancient civilization.
Yeah.
And I think there are two rocket parts per layer, per mine layer, mine floor. And you need to get six of them or something like that. I don't know. I've gotten four so far and gotten down to the next layer. And by the second floor of the mine, which is the third layer, because it's the ground level is one and then two and three, there's a little, it's not really tower defense, but there's a thing where there are enemies and you have to fight them, and there are these nests that are close to where the rocket parts were, and once you get to the third floor they periodically spawn more bugs, but you build turrets there and just sort of ignore, at least what I've seen. Somewhere around that point was the last time I played and stopped. So
you went much further than I did. I've just kind of gotten near the beginning ish area done, and I you said everything that needs to be said about it in general for how it works and the games and stuff, and well done, by the way. I just want to give my kind of thoughts, and I think that it was fun. It's a fun game to play. It's much like the SteamWorld games and all the rest of the SteamWorld games, that it picks a genre. You have fun in it, but it's not a really complex sim of whatever that game might be. And it's also not a little baby game that's really just simple blocks, you know. And you tend to have an adventure associated with it. Somehow you seem real dig. You have a goal with some story type stuff to it. And then, you know, SteamWorld Heist the same way. It's got a genre and mechanics, but you're actually, but they actually put a little story with it, and the characters kind of matter, and a little, or at least they have character right to them. So this did that. They took the SteamWorld model and applied it to a building type sim thing. And it works. I don't feel overwhelmed or too complicated on things. If I don't have to go in and let's say if it's like one of those zoo games or the roller coaster tycoon things where, well, I better go in and change the amount of ice in the soda by 2% so that I can get more money. You know, stuff like that just drives me insane. I'm not saying that it's not bad for people who absolutely love it, but it's not for me. And a SteamWorld build doesn't, you don't have to do all that stuff. You could just, you know, put another foresting logging camp in or something to increase your logging problem. And it's just very straightforward, simple enough. And I can see myself enjoying it, playing it all the way. And because of that, playing it all the way through the end and saying, nice, I got my $20 worth, you know.
Yeah.
And feeling good about that. Because I think if it was a $60, $70 game, then you're going to be like, I should be able to control the ice in the cups, you know?
Sure.
So I get that.
Yeah, it's kind of, that's a good way to describe this franchise. And I've only played a couple of them, but it's a town builder. And like, you know, when I see the negative or less favorable reviews on Steam, it's usually people saying that there's not enough depth. They're like, you do this, yeah, and you do this a couple more times, and that's pretty much it. Like, I wanted more out of this. And it's, you know, it's okay to want something different out of a thing. But it's not, you know, it's not an idle clicker game, right? It's more complex than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's not, you know, it's not SimCity or fact Oreo. Like it's much lighter than those. While still being a real game.
Say. I fully agree, and I give it a thumbs up. Glad I bought it. If you like town building games, and you like the SteamWorld franchise, this is definitely good. So definite buy, easy buy. No problem. There's a lot other games I've played that I've gotten less out of enjoyment for more money that have been in depth or that have been more money and not and more shallow. So this just hits a nice little medium sweet spot and fills that thing just like the rest of the SteamWorld games. Good on them. I'm glad. I hope they keep making them. They made like a deck builder type one, like Slay the Spire. They've made one like that. You know, Heist is its own kind of thing, strategy stuff. So good for this company to go into different genres and being able to put their stamp on it and doing pretty good on them. So it's not always an easy thing to do is, you know, change genres so easily. And they do that. What did I have? I had one where I rented one from the library on a game from the library, on the recommendation of a buddy Aaron, and it's called Unicorn Overlord. I had no idea what this was. And I was like, okay, he's like, you should try it. I was like, okay. And I talked to him this last Thursday after I played it, and he said, so what'd you think? I was like, it's a lot. And he's like, yeah. I was like, well, I don't mean that in a bad way. It's just, it's a game that I need to own and not rent. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to sit down and dedicate your time to this game because it's a thing. It's a kind of got a lot of role-playing elements and Japanese thing. It looks very anime. It's got a lot of very anime theme to it, or JRPG. I shouldn't say anime. JRPG stuff to it. It's not a JRPG. It's got auto battler stuff in the way that, let's say you're playing a Final Fantasy game. Here's a good example. You're playing a classic Final Fantasy game, and you come up to a combat, a random encounter, and it's six imps and your red mage, your black mage, your fighter, and your monk, right? And instead of choosing cure for the white mage and fire for the black mage, it just does it automatically. Everything's done automatically. It's auto battler in that way. They just, you know, if you have attack, he does his best attack. If he has a defense thing, he does a defense thing in the battle. And you can even hit skip or fast forward. There's no real decisions in that combat. Okay. It's like your team buildup.
Like a mobile game.
Kind of like a mobile game in that way. And that's really simplifying it. You know, that is how combat so far that I've played it does work. And just by saying that makes me... it's going to make it sound bad. It's not bad. That's actually a really cool thing that I don't have to make those choices, that I can just rely on building my team. There's like the game says there's over 60 characters that you can find along the way, and they're all different. So maybe I just mentioned the Final Fantasy thing where you have your black mage, white mage, fighter, and monk or something. Well, you manage multiple teams. So there's the big world map that you're going on, and you see, oh, there's an enemy down there at a castle. Well, you send one of your teams down that way, and he starts walking. Why, another one goes to defend a bridge, and another one goes to that. So you have multiple teams going on a map at once, trying to get to the objective. So one team will fight a battle in the ruins, and it's made up of a monk, a wizard, a thief, and something else. The other one is two paladins and a sorcerer, or some kind of thing, right? So you have multiple teams that you make and give them abilities, level them up, change their specialties and their abilities. So you're kind of it's more about managing teams and characters and leveling up and getting them gear and such like that along the way. It's got a big story to it. It's got a very JRPG kind of cinematic story. Lots of on the map, go help the villagers find some roots outside in the garden. So you send a team over there and discover caves and roots and stuff like that. Very high quality production values, high quality voice work that's in it. Lots of good voice work throughout it. The systems are simple and straightforward. Every character is different and exciting. So it sounds, if you just read the stats about this game, you'd think, oh man, it seems very complicated. It can be, or very deep. It can be, but it's still fun and engaging. but there is so much of it that I can't just lightly pick up and play it. It's not one that you say, I got a half hour, I can play, knock a little bit of this out, play it. Absolutely not. You got to spend 2 hours at a time to play things and get through emissions and stuff like that. And then listen to more story and make decisions on the story and such. So it's a serious game. And while I like it, there's so many other serious games that I've got to play right now, you know? So Unicorn Overlord, definitely a good game. Definitely a thumbs up. If you like JRPGs with a different kind of way of doing combat and stuff with a little bit of tactics, it's actually more tactics than it is like a traditional RPG. Look, check it out. Watch some videos. It's very fun. You'll like it. And it's worth its full price for sure. Not one of those ones that's overpriced. It's a good one. A solid buy.
Cool.
Not necessarily for me right now, but if I found it on a bargain bin, I'd pick it up. So in hopes that someday I could play it. Cool. Can we do Shogun yet?
All right. Yes.
Yeah, all right, Shogun.
Okay, we're going to talk about the FX series Shogun. We've both seen all of it. So if you've not seen it or not finished it, hit the bell. Well, you can hear the bell. I've had trouble with the microphone picking up my bell. Yeah, we're going to spoil it. So if you don't want to...
We're going to spoil it all. So go away.
Skip ahead. And we're basically at the end of the episode. So you could just be done. We might have final thoughts at the end.
Okay, Dennis, what did you think of the series? I feel like this is a series that you would love. I mean, we've talked about it over thing, and I know you do like it.
But I mean, yeah,
now that you've seen the things, it feels like it's kind of like your show.
We've heard my impressions on this as I went on. I was nervous because I heard some bold claims about it early on. A lot of people are calling it a masterpiece. My brother said the first episode to him was like the first episode of Game of Thrones in terms of like just hooking you into the story. And I was hooked into the story, but it's pretty hard to top Game of Thrones, I think, because I read the books. Like, it's just a different... It's like compare stuff to Lord of the Rings for me.
Sure.
Which I might have said that exact thing last week. Aside from... It'll probably be a series that I rewatch in 6 months to a year or something. I had a hard time early on keeping a lot of the male characters apart, the Japanese men.
I'm with you. But
even still, there were moments where I'm like, the early on they get to the village and the people are all cheering for the other guy. I think it's Yabushige-sama, and Torunaga gives a speech, and then they start cheering for him. And there's just a lot of power play. There's a lot of politics and subtle, like, intrigue, and you're following this guy, John Blackthorne, who really at no point is in control of his life or his destiny in any way.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
yeah.
Like, no matter what he thinks about what's going on, Torunaga is pulling strings and fully committing to everything. I mean, to the point where, you know, one of his oldest friends commits seppuku because he will not give up the secret of what he's planning.
He is 100% playing chess.
Yeah.
The people are people's lives on the board for sure. He says that early, like very early. I want to say episode one or two, he talks to his son, and his son says something to the effect of, "Are you proud of me, Dad? Or shouldn't you let me handle that because I'm your son?" Or some kind of thing. And he has a very stern look a lot in this film. Sanada, the actor playing Torunaga, he gives a stern thing like, you seem to think that emotions and relationships matter. Everything is to be used, and everything is to, you know, is a for the bigger picture, no matter what. At no point does he see any single person as more important than his decisions to do whatever he wants to do. And whether that's, and as you see, I think in the last episode especially, it's for his own goals, whether they're good or bad, and that's somewhat ambiguous. You don't really know, you know, what his plan, you kind of get his plan at the end, which I don't want to talk about yet. We'll talk, we'll move on that in a minute. But he's not necessarily a good guy. He is, I think. And I think you're led to believe that he's a good guy throughout the whole thing. But I don't think it's like that. I don't think it's black and white or honor versus dishonor or stuff like that. I think it's literally just one man's desire for what he wants, and he's using his will to make that happen in the world. And that's not good or bad.
Right. It's I mean, it depends on what those goals are. I think we're meant to believe toward the end that his goals are noble, but there's a little bit of at what cost
kind of thing. Well, okay. Well, I guess we can talk about that now, because there's a lot on the show I want to talk about, but I'll start with the big one. Let's start with the big one. Questions to you. It's Yabushige makes, who I think is one of the best characters in the series. We're in spoilers now, so he's getting ready to commit harikari, which I'm not sure the difference between that and seppuku, which they both kill themselves type thing.
I don't know if they ever say harikiri. That might be a different...
Oh, well, I watched the English dub and the subtitles. In the subtitles in the English dub, he says that. He says it multiple times. Yeah.
Interesting.
And they say seppuku for all the rest of the series when they're talking to different people.
Sometimes they say, like, slit your belly or cut open your belly, which is, you know, a little literal description of what they do. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. So, and man, I just spent all day talking about this series, but it's everything they do in this thing, from translating from the non-English dub and in the English dub, is super intentional. And you listen to the podcast stuff that they do on these and the after show debriefs. Everything with the English dub is intentional. Everything with the non-English dub is very intentional on how it's presented, how it's said, when it's in colored subtitles or not colored subtitles. It's all just a masterclass on how to do something beautifully and wonderful. So transfer that into the last scene, or last thing, where Toranaga is talking to Yashibe. Yabushige, mm-hmm. he asks him, he looks up and says, "You did this all so that you could become shogun. Is that right?" And he puts his katana on his shoulder and says, "Why tell the future to a dead man?" And then he looks at him and he stabs him, and Yabushige stabs himself and he chops mm-hmm. off his head. So he doesn't say no.
Right.
And the title of the show is Shogun. And at no point do we have a shogun. Nor does anyone in there openly say they're trying to be shogun until this very last thing where he tells him, and it dawns on him, you're trying to be emperor of all that surveys. And he could eat, Toranaga could easily have said, no, I'm not going to. You know, you're wrong. All he said is, after all this time, I thought you'd know better. You'd know the best, you know. So do you think that you just said that he was very noble in his thing. I don't think that's a noble thing, to sacrifice things and to move pieces around just so you can be emperor one day. Do you think that's his plan?
I think if I don't know, it made me curious as to whether there were, you know, like what true historical events inspired the story? Because it's a novel, right? It's fiction.
It's an older novel, I found.
Yeah, it's like from the 70s.
I
talked to my dad. He actually read it, like, way back 40 years ago.
And it does end like the book ends. I've read that. Everybody says it's exactly, everything ends like it.
Yeah, so he couldn't really remember the details. it made me wonder if any of these characters were, like, if John Blackthorne was real, if Toranaga was real, like, who they were, what they did. Like,
I have not looked any of that up or not.
Deadwood kind of thing, where you're like, yeah, this guy was real, but he, or like Ara, right, where both of those characters were real people, but did not meet and go on crazy adventures like they did in the film. The only reason I say, you know, that his goal is noble is because I think he wants peace. Now, he seems to want peace through conquest. Not even conquest, but like by winning, right? Yeah, like
in conquest of his enemies in some way.
Right, but not through force. Whether or not that's because he doesn't want to, you know, he doesn't want the, you know, how do I say this? Like, he doesn't seem to want to take that power through military force. Whether that is a principle or just practicality, right? Like, he can't take it by force because he doesn't have the numbers, right? He doesn't have the troops to actually do it that way. He's got to do it politically. And so if that's the only reason that I say it's noble, like, if his goal is that he wants peace, like, that's a good thing. I don't know, like, sacrificing the people, like, that gets into some different philosophy, right? And Japanese philosophy, especially ancient Japanese philosophy, is very different from Western philosophy. There's some overlaps, right? Like, we had knights, and I mean, we still have knights technically, but they're not the same. You know, we had knights, and the knights had a code, right? The code of chivalry, right? That they followed, like, you do this, you don't do this. And in Japan, they had samurai, and samurai had the Bushido code. You know, so there's some overlap, there's some similarities. You know, we have ideas of honor and loyalty and all that, but you know, they have this sort of, you get this a little bit in the Godzilla Minus One movie, right? Like, these philosophies carried as far as World War II. I think a lot of them have gone by the wayside in the decades that followed, when they saw how a fascist dictator can really abuse those noble qualities, those honorable beliefs. You know, for things like kamikaze bombers and stuff like that. Though that's a whole different conversation. And in some cases, like with Mariko, like, you obviously hope that something happens between her and Blackthorne, right? Most of the story seems to hint that that was coming, or was at least a possibility. Except, something I kept forgetting is that she doesn't want to keep living.
Yeah.
Right.
She's very open about that through the whole thing.
It keeps coming back up, and you forget. And like, the scene in the penultimate episode, when they're trying to leave and the samurai are going to stop them, the guards. And, she gets that spear. I don't think it's a spear, but whatever that weapon's called, the long.
Oh, the it's like the Naga Nida or something like that.
Something like that. It's staff. It's a little bit like a halberd. And like, I was expecting a big epic fight. Like, you know, everybody's underestimating her because she's a woman, but we've seen all these training flashbacks where we know she's competent with this weapon, and she gets maybe knocks down a couple of them, and that's it, because there's a dozen of them, right? And she's one person.
I appreciated that they didn't make her like an invincible Oh, yeah. Now she's a super ninja.
Yeah, it was like after watching Salt, right? Where
right.
Angelina Jolie, like, no matter what, she could be in a car with 5 CIA agents, and she's still going to walk away when they all die somehow.
Yeah, but this was very. She was very good. Like, she held her own as much as a person would that's highly trained in a more realistic way.
Right,
but. Yeah, it was much more realistic way in that, and I appreciate it. So, okay, moving from the main guy to, you know, it's funny. Along with the engine, I kind of also got more deeper into the world of the Japanese traditions and stuff. So I don't just call Mariko anymore. Don't call her. Try to think of how to say this. Instead of calling her, it's Mariko. Oh, yes, Mariko. It's Mariko-sama.
Mariko-sama.
And yeah, and because it just that feels like that's the right way to call her. Although Sama is a title or an honorific. Right? So it's a character. I'm not honoring a character. So calling her Mariko is fine. But because of the way that this show was so, it felt very personal, and all the characters I was really invested in, calling her Mariko-sama makes sense, you know. And you know,
it's like when that priest comes back and he calls her Lady Maria, I'm like, who's this guy? Get the F out of here.
Exactly. Yes. I mean, he keeps calling her Maria, and I'm like, oh, you're just trying to put your Christian beliefs in this thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, or Fujidomo, and, you know, we don't know when Yabushige calls him, like Engine Domo, don't know. I'm like, oh, he's giving him kind of an honorific, and when it's not Sama, but still Dono, I'm like, that means something. Whether Yabushige is saying it for a reason, because he's kind of a manipulator in certain ways,
right?
Or he's a survivalist in ways.
Yeah.
It's still that honorific made sense, and that's something I think I really love about Shogun, and I recommend it to people for many reasons, but it, like, if you want to understand like ancient Japanese culture and some of the things they still do today with like honorifics, this helps. Just the same way, if you just follow John Blackthorne as your character of point of view, he learns and I learned in the same way. And when he pushed away his people and didn't know how to think, I felt kind of that same way. It's like, I get it. I get like how England and knights and kings and queens and the Protestants versus Catholics, I get all that. And how now I also get how none of that really matters here. You know, it's a side show compared to what's happening in Japan, and the culture and how their people mean, and what harikari means, and what seppuku and things like that means to the people. So, yeah, anyway, the honorifics were something. So how did you, I kind of went on bad rabbit hole there. How did you feel about Mariko-sama dying in the second to last episode?
I mean,
like, there's a whole, I guess the conversation is how do you feel about, they went a long way about her killing herself, and you knew that she wanted to die. He said that she had a part to play. They sent her there. The whole episode is with her about ready to kill herself. So you're kind of being dragged on. How'd you feel about that? And then how she ultimately died, how you feel about that? So there's kind of a multi-part question there. And get your feelings and thoughts on the character. And
I mean, it sheds a lot of light on Torunaga-sama. And I think one of the characters even says this. Like, he sent a woman to do what his army couldn't do, like get the hostages out of Osaka.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what she did. I don't know. I don't think. No. She didn't have to die to accomplish that goal until you get to the very end with the battle and you understand why we've spent so much screen time with the other woman.
Fuji, is it Fuji?
Fuji, the mother of the heir, the like dowager.
That name I always got Daimyo, confused with. Yeah,
whatever. I don't remember her name.
But the consort mother.
Yeah, yeah. She was a consort to the prior, not daimyo, Taiko.
Oh, it's the Ochiba Nokata. That's her name.
Ochiba.
It's the Nokata that I couldn't get Ochiba. They call her, and then they called her Ochiba Nokata. I was like, okay, that for some reason that rolled better off my tongue, and I looked it up. Like, oh yeah, duh.
Yeah. But she, right? She's the mother of the heir, right? And the heir, that's the whole thing there.
Mother consort.
That's sort of right. So she has no power of her own. She's honored, if not respected, by people because she was able to bear the prior. I keep forgetting his title. I want to say Taiko. I don't know.
Taiko, right. Yeah.
To bear him an heir, right? So there is succession, right, in the nobility, but the heir is too young, right? It's like the regency in England.
Yeah.
That's the whole, like, status quo of politics when the series starts. But she's still the heir's mother. So she has influence over him that nobody else has.
Yeah.
And she, when she was young, was friends with Mariko.
Right.
And so when Mariko dies, she convinces the heir to not to side with Torunaga, but to sit out the battle, basically. Like, yeah. And the heir, being the heir, has this massive army that would have made, you know, would have tipped the balance of the battle to one side or the other. But without that army, Torunaga's army would be able to stand and defend against Ishido.
Yeah, I will say that's one thing that was a little disappointing. And I understand, again, by listening to the writers and the directors and stuff about following the book and getting that stuff, is that I was a little disappointed that the plan, air quotes I'm using, was such a small scene that he just talks about in 3 months' time, this is what's going to happen.
It's like a flash forward, yeah.
Yeah, flash forward. And I felt a little sad that obviously could have been, we could have seen that go forward and, you know, put two episodes on there or however it works so you can see it happen. Would have been nice to have that dramatic tension and I could just see that all play out, but it's not how the book went. So yeah. They stayed true to how the book went instead of, as we say, trying to milk the series and add more extra stuff and things. They just did what the book was because they loved the book. They wanted to get exactly how the book was to the people, the viewers, us, you know, who hadn't been exposed to this. And they did that. So I can't fault them for that, but it was a little disappointing. So I guess that's my disappointment in the ending of the book, I should say. Not going on further with that.
Sure.
I like Mariko Sama a lot. You're right. You had talked about Anna Sawai. Is that how you say her name? Sawai? We both absolutely could not stand her in Monarch and just complained about her and the other cast members a lot. And then you had said that she was pretty good in here, or in general, she's pretty good. I agree. For the first half, I had made a comment about how she doesn't do a whole lot and she's very proper, so she doesn't have a lot of acting chops to be shown. And I still maintain that. But as the series went on and she does have more scenes and very subtle things, she's very good with those. I don't know if that's directing or however it is, but she was really good as an actress in that. One of my most favorite scenes in the entire series was when the engine, when Blackthorn has to take a consort because Torunaga-sama gave him a consort. Mm-hmm. And so he kind of has to do that. And they go to like the tea house. Mm-hmm. And the lady is like the best pro thing of all the world. And it obviously you can see where the girl from Firefly is inspired from, that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah. Right. But how she comes and she starts to speak and she intentionally positions herself on the diagonal so that when she's speaking, he has to look through Mariko-sama to hear it, and she kind of looks forward, but ever so slightly looks at him occasionally as the words are being spoken. And it's just such an emotional thing and so expertly said and written that it just gives me chills now, even thinking about how well that was crafted, directed, acted, written. Like, what a great piece of film.
Yeah. I mean, most of the time when I talk about this show, and I will try to find and link this YouTube video, because they talk about, I think the title is like, Shogun makes translation fun, or I don't know.
Yeah.
Fun is
agreed.
The word they use.
Agreed. Yes.
But
I'm aware.
So much like, you know, the text translated into Japanese and then accurate, or, you know, as accurate as can be, ancient Japanese, and then again into English in the subtitles, mm-hmm. and then back in some cases, like back and forth, and then like major story points hinge on translation, right, and miscommunication or different kinds of communication. I think I've said this before, where there are conversations between Blackthorn and Tornaga where Mariko is interpreting, not just translating, but interpreting what both of them are saying.
Right.
Like Tornaga says something that could be, you know, a little bit of a slight or a jab, and, you know, she says, "My lord asked if you slept well." And Blackthorn will say, you know, something else with some snide remark in it, and she'll, you know, like mediating as a diplomat between these two. And
right.
And then you have things like the old gardener and the pheasant. Is it a pheasant?
Yeah.
Whatever the bird was. And that is maybe the first time, I don't know for sure if it's the first time, but it's possibly the first time that he, Blackthorn tries to communicate in Japanese to someone else without Mariko there. And his words are so misinterpreted that old gardener dies.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're like, that's huge. Or later in the scene with her husband, with Mariko's husband, where, you know, there's just this kind of machismo showing off, and this culture of like he wants Blackthorn wants to hear his war stories, right? And he's like, he doesn't say this, but it's understood, you know, he and Mariko both understand that's not something they do in Japan. They don't boast
right.
about men they've killed. Like, the only people who are excited and thrilled by battle are the son, like, I think it's
the young people.
Tornaga's son, who hasn't been in battle, right, and is
yeah.
hungry for glory and all this stuff, and then he dies in the most, like,
when he dies, I was like, oh my god, did he just
stupidest way. And I mean, just driving home that philosophy and the stuff with the earthquakes. The earthquake thing baffled me because I've watched so much Japanese content, right? Like films,
yeah.
anime, a couple live action things, and somehow had never heard about this, like, constant threat of earthquakes. When it makes
I totally agree with that, but it makes sense, right? They're on the Ring of Fire. They're like the most volcanic area ever.
They're on the Ring of Fire. The archipelago of Japan is just filled with volcanoes. Mount Fuji is a volcano. They have public bathhouses because they have hot springs, like hot spring onsen, they call them, all over the place, right? And you're like, well, yeah, of course there's stuff like earthquakes.
How had we not seen that in more Japanese media?
Right, you know, just kind of baffling to me. But it influences that philosophy of their lives being fragile, and the that reality affecting their philosophy in things like honor and seppuku, and, like, you know, in the case of both Mariko and Fuji, they, like, their whole families are gone, right? Their families have gone on to the spirit realm, or, you know, whatever, in the afterlife, and they're stuck here, forbidden to leave this life by their duty and obligation to whomever, Toranaga in this case.
I want to give a couple shout outs on this cast to Fuji-sama, the actress. I can't remember her name. Her last name's Hoshi. Just really well done from start to finish. The character is very, very an interesting character in her journey. And all the way down to culminating to on the canoe with Blackthorn and him talking to her and having the time to give the ashes out from very first episode of her husband and her newborn baby and where she came with that to the last scene where you see them sitting in the rain on the porch and it's in the thirds where he's in the middle, she's on the right, and there's the missing Mariko-sama on the left. And it just pauses for like 3 seconds in there as the rain comes down and both of them are quiet. And you know it's because they're missing that person. Mm-hmm. And then after that, maybe it was like a 5-10 second pause, he just says, there's no interpreter.
No translator.
No translator. You know, and you're like, you know exactly what that means. You know, and both of them don't respond. They just sit there. And it's like, that was such a good, wonderful scene. She has, when they're at the dinner table, she's the fourth person in that room. When they're talking, her husband, what's his name? They're at a dinner table they're at a dinner where Mariko-sama's husband, and his name's drawing a blank for me right now. He is making her tell Mariko-sama, tell her history of her family to him.
Right.
They get drunk and stuff. And yeah, Fuji-sama is in that scene. She's there with them as the house consort. And she is doing some incredible face acting. Like, it's hard to do face acting in the way that these people do the face acting because it's restrained face acting, you know, where small movements mean monumental things, you know. And she is just showing us a masterclass in that scene, that actress is, of how much of an important person she is in that role and to these different people with just her looks. Mm-hmm. And I was like, Anna Sawai was saying the words and the other guy is giving his big angry thing. And obviously Cosmo Jarvis as Blackthorn is saying a lot of words too. Hoshi doesn't say anything and is still very powerful. So I really liked her character and just every character throughout. By the end, you said there were some, I had some problems mixing some characters. By the end, I knew them all. I could see their faces. There were some names that I was hard to say. I always got Yabushige, his name. I got confused and messed up in my mouth until I had to say it like 6 times. just so much of the show is fantastic. Oh, another shout out to Lady Io. She's the tea house owner, and how she does a little bit of a thing. It's a Stick of Time is the name of the episode. And she gets the stick of time once the tea house and shout out to the writers when, or the book writer, I should say, when he has, Torunaga gives the Catholic people a church in Edo, but it's right next to the tea house.
To the tea house, yeah.
Which was fantastic. That's the one time I laughed. I went, ha, ah, real loud in the room. So yeah, and obviously, Cosmo Jarvis was fantastic as John Blackthorne. He was a good point of view character. I really appreciated him and his character throughout the whole thing. Ishido was probably a weak one. He's the main, I guess, villain, air quotes, you'll say. But I think he's supposed to be a kind of a weak leader.
Yeah.
In general. So, and the kids were appropriately kids. I don't mean kids, but I mean like 20 something, whatever.
Oh, sure.
Nakanado and the other son, nephew. Mm-hmm. So they acted appropriately as they were supposed to and fit those roles well. So, and I could go all day about this, but yes, super thumbs up, 12 out of 10. Love this series. We'll watch it again.
Yeah. Just incredibly well made.
Yes. From every person, actor, writer, director, cast, set piece, designs. Yes. Everything.
Yeah. And it's refreshing to see an adaptation done so well. I've not read the book, so who knows? But, you know, it's a little bit like the Fallout thing where I'm like, I don't really know, but I feel like if there were major issues or complaints, I would have heard about it.
Yeah.
Somewhere on the internet.
Right? You know, the one thing I want to say as we're way, way, way over time on this show is, our show mm-hmm. is, I have a hard time saying I would recommend this though, because you really have to pay attention. You have to really want to know or be semi-interested in Japanese ancient culture and history, not necessarily yeah. history, but their culture. And if that's the idea of honor and that feeling is kind of foreign to you or not as important, then I don't know if I would recommend this to you. I don't think you would get it. And I don't know how to say that to somebody or to judge that from somebody.
Yeah, maybe.
Like, I don't want to say anyone that we know, but, you know, some people that we know wouldn't find this interesting. They just, it's not their kind of thing to think about, you know, or whatever. Whereas a Game of Thrones might, because it's got a different kind of intrigue to it, you know, more brutal intrigue.
I could see that a little bit.
Okay, cool. That's what we got, man. We're way, way over on this one, but, you know, I wanted to talk about
the show. All right. Wow, yeah, almost 2 hours. Okay.
Fallout. I'm on to Fallout now after this.
All right. I'm done that one already because I dropped it all at once. All right. You've been listening to Front Porches, episode 347. Thanks always to our friends at LRM Online. Check them out for reviews. If you want to email us with questions or comments, you can do that at frontporchpod@gmail.com. Is that address? You can go to our website, frontporchpodcast.com, where I will put links to the various things we discussed. And there are also contact forms there to reach out to us. If you enjoyed the show, please consider subscribing. And on any of those services you use, if you give us a favorable review, we always appreciate that. It helps us out in the rankings. As always, thanks so much for joining us. And until next time, I'm Dennis.
And I'm Michael.
For the Front Porch.
Night, everybody.
See you next time.